Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the Explores, time traveling through history, one era at a time. I'm Kate Armstrong. Happy Women's History Month, listeners! I've been keeping busy crafting all new episodes, which will start making their debut in April. But I couldn't let this month go by without sharing something on the main feed. This bonus episode was first published on Patreon as a companion to our episode on Boudica and Zenobia, two rulers who went up against ancient Rome. In this bonus, we'll meet three other women warriors who dared to do the same. If you like it, you'll find many more bonus episodes over on my Patreon. Don't worry, current patrons. I'm about to publish an all-new bonus just for you. And starting next month, I'll be dropping not one, but two bonus episodes a month for patrons, so there's never been a better time to hop aboard. Now, grab your weapon of choice and your favorite armor. Let's go traveling. But first, a shout-out to some of my patrons. My newest pirate queen, Elena. My newest lady president, Hannah. My newest boss lady, Madison. My warrior queens, Alexis, Amanda, Ika, Jessica, June, Neve, and Sloane, Samantha, and Sarah. My imperial empresses, Bridget, Alyssa, Faye and Whimsy Soapworks, Katie, Samara, and Teresa. And my Lady Pharaohs, Cheryl, Kat, Kate, Kimberly, Laura, Lori, Sophie, and the fabulous Courtneys. This episode and the show would not be possible without the generous support of all my patrons. For just a few dollars a month, they get each episode early and completely ad-free. Exclusive bonus episodes, prizes, discounts on merch, full interviews with guests, and more. To find out all about it, just go to my website, theexplorespodcast.com. I hope you've listened to and enjoyed our episode on Boudica and Zenobia. There's something stirring about a warrior woman, one who refuses to bow down to the forces against her, no matter how vast they may be. And when they win out, even better. In this bonus episode, I give you three more sword-wielding females who went up against the Romans, terrifying all who looked upon them. Now, you think we didn't have much to go on when it comes to Boudica and Zenobia. There's even less by way of sources for these three epic queens, but we can explore the scraps history's left us and imagine up the rest as we see fit. We begin in Illyria, which is roughly in modern-day Albania, in the 3rd century BCE. You remember Illyria from our episodes on Olympias, right? The Illyrians were the ones who caused King Philip II of Macedonia a lot of trouble in the form of skirmishes along his border. And I know you could never forget about Sinane, Alexander the Great's Amazon-inspired half-sister. She of the horse-riding, bow-wielding, and terrifying prowess in war? Yes, we're talking about that Illyria. When trying to picture this queen's way of life, it pays to think about Olympias' clannish upbringing. The Illyrians are proud and feudal, wielding weapons and tools of both copper and iron. Councils of elders choose the chieftains who head each of the Illyrian tribes, who are often at odds with each other. Just like in Britannia, they don't see themselves as some united Illyrian nation. The name Illyria is one used by the Greeks and Romans to describe all these peoples, but not one they use for themselves. This is a land full of fearsome warriors, but none more so than those who come from the Ardea tribe. That's where we'll find our Lady Teuta. Based on Illyria's central coast, this kingdom goes through a rapid period of growth in Teuta's lifetime under a king named Akron. He focuses his energies on building up their navy, which is legend, using it to extend their power further. He unites several tribes under his banner and even conquers some Greek peoples too. Then, according to legend, he drank so much in celebration that he got real sick and died. Whoops. But behind every great king is a great queen, just waiting for him to die of pleurisy. We don't know if Teuta is her actual name. It literally means Mistress of the People, so it could be a title. And it's clear from the get-go, she's more than ready to rule. She does it as regent for her stepson, and she thinks it's a great idea that her late husband wanted to expand their holdings. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know? And so her armies attack the regions of Elis and Messenia. On their way home from that, they stop off to capture the Greek city of Phoenice, Epirus's most prosperous trading town. But truly, it's not her powerful navy the people grow to be afraid of. It's her band of roving pirates. Yes, Teuta is a mighty pirate queen. Piracy has a very long history, and it's not always considered disreputable, especially if you're a queen who gets to reap its spoils. It's legal at this time in Illyria, considered a totally viable profession. Hey, what's your son do? Oh, he's a pirate. It's said that Teuta uses them to pillage her neighbors indiscriminately, commanding her officers to treat anyone outside their ranks as the enemy. That includes Italian merchants. Right now, Rome's a republic on the rise. They've just defeated their great rival, Carthage, and they're keen to build their brand and their reach. Teuta's pirates are a huge nuisance, stealing their goods and disturbing trade routes. Eventually, enough merchants complain that it seems as if something's gotta be done. Around 230 BCE, the Republic sends two ambassadors over to Teuta in the city of Skodra.
Hey, they say. Listen, I don't know if you know this, but we're kind of a big deal. So can you please just get these pirates under control and pay us back for all the booty they took? Thanks.
But Teuta refuses. I mean, piracy's legal where she comes from, and sometimes a pirate's just got a pirate. She's so insulted that Rome thinks they have any right to ask her for favors that she holds one of the ambassadors hostage and kills the other one. Apparently, that old adage, don't kill the messenger, has not yet made its way to Illyria. This seems like a pretty terrible idea, but, as ancient writer Polybius helpfully points out, she is a woman, and thus has a
woman's natural shortness of view.
Bite me, Polybius. When Rome hears, they know the time for talk is over. Now it's time to go to war. In 229, the Romans send 200 ships, full up with 20,000 soldiers, across the Adriatic Sea. Teuta isn't worried. She has forces, and she has her commander's loyalty, right? Right? When the Romans get to the island city of Corcyra, a local governor and her lieutenant betray her, joining up with Team Rome. Rude! Cassius Dio tells us that Teuta actually sends that lieutenant over herself to Corcyra, telling him to give it to the Romans in exchange for a truce. But shortly after, Teuta attacks both Epidamnus and Apollonia. She isn't afraid to poke the Roman bear. That's what I'm trying to say. The Roman troops march up the coast, pillaging towns with abandon, until they reach the Ardean capital city of Skodra. Little by little, Teuta is forced to retreat, much as Zenobia will do centuries later. She swiftly loses what's called the First Illyrian War. She's forced to pay Rome tribute and to relinquish most of her power and lands to them. Rather than put up with their overlording, she chooses to step down and off the throne. We think she lives for decades more, though the end of her life is murky. Another story has it that she throws herself over a cliff rather than surrender. That cliff is in Risan, the only town along the coast without a seafaring tradition. Rumor has it that's because of the curse the Illyrian pirate queen laid on the place before jumping, her rage reaching out from her watery grave. Now we fast forward a couple hundred years to Amonarenus. She lives in the kingdom of Kush, south of Egypt, in Nubia, or modern-day Sudan. Like Egypt, their civilization also grows up around the Nile, south of Abu Simbel. There's still a lot we don't know about Kush, which is a shame, because it's one of the world's great ancient civilizations, and helped define northeastern Africa's cultural and political landscape. Three Kushite kingdoms dominated Nubia for more than 3,000 years. They don't start writing down their stories until the Meroitic period, which is the period we find Amonarenus in. So much of our knowledge comes from Egyptian sources, and those sources often show pharaohs smiting Kush. The Egyptians sure do love their smiting. But this isn't just a civilization on Egypt's outskirts, oh no. It actually conquered Egypt during its 25th dynasty, kicking off 100 years of black Kushite pharaohs that created a stable government, expelled invaders, and sparked a major religious revival. Nice work, guys. And even when they're at odds, Egypt and Kush have plenty of economic and political interaction. Kush is a key transit point between Egypt and sub-Saharan Africa, and its deserts are rich in iron and gold. They build great temples and pyramids, carve great art, and even discover an early antibiotic. Nubian mummies have been found with tetracycline in their bones, which these days is used to treat everything from acne and malaria to syphilis. It seems to have found its way into their beer, and once they figured out what it did, they kept on drinking it. They were famous for their archery. Both men and women knew how to expertly wield a bow. You know that when the Egyptians call your country Ta Seti, or Land of Bows, you must be pretty good at shooting down fast-moving targets. Nubian archers sometimes even fight for Egyptian pharaohs as mercenaries. Amonarenus is their Kandake, the title for a ruling queen, which gives us the modern-day name Candace, between 40 and 10 BCE. Her reign coincided with Cleopatra's, those final bright days of conquest when she and Mark Antony ruled together. You know, before they crashed and burned. You know what happens next. Octavian moves in, annexes Egypt, and thinks,
you know, that land down south looks pretty good in terms of fertile land and trade routes, and I hear there's gold and stuff in the desert. Maybe me and my troops should just keep on marching.
Amonarenus, her husband, and their son, Prince Akinadad, have to make some quick strategic moves. Her country is rich in resources, and they have a kicking fighting force, but it's smaller than Rome's. She could just hunker down in a defensive position and wait for the Romans to come to her. But no, Amonarenus takes 30,000 of her best fighters and goes on the offensive, marching up to meet the threat head-on. While Aelius Gallus, the chief magistrate in Egypt, is making war over in Arabia, the Kushites move in, winning victories at Syene and Philae. She loses her husband in one of these battles, we think, but that doesn't stop Amonarenus. She captures at least two Roman-held cities, defacing statues of Augustus all the way. Augustus, of course, is deeply angry. How dare this woman take his lands and draw mustaches on his likeness? So his main military man, Petronius, retaliates by marching south to one of their most important cities, Napata. They sack it, enslaving thousands of Nubians. Augustus thinks he's heard the last of this Nubian queen. And who can blame him? For many, this would be a decisive death blow. But the fight's not over yet. Amonarenus gathers her forces and goes nuts on the Romans in a series of intensive attacks. There's a piece of art that shows her squaring up against her enemies with a sword in one hand and her pet lion at the other. It also shows her feeding her enemies to that lion, so damn. Some reports say she even brings war elephants to the party. No matter her tactics, they're clearly effective. The fighting goes on for 3 long years. At one point, it's said, Amonarenus is blinded in one eye. She lets it heal, hopefully puts on an eye patch to terrify all comers, and heads back out into the fight. Eventually, she wears Rome down. They get so tired of the whole business that they sign a peace treaty with the Nubians called the Treaty of Samos. And that treaty actually favors Amonarenus. The Romans say they'll leave their lands and even cancel all their taxes. The Nubian kingdom will survive for another 300 years, all thanks to her. In the early 1900s, archaeologists will finally start exploring what remains of the kingdom of Kush. It's there that they will find a perfectly preserved head from one of Augustus's statues, strategically positioned under a carving of a Kushite ruler, so it looks like he is stepping on it. We don't know which ruler it depicts, but let's assume it's a Monarenus, making Rome bow down, even in death. Some 100 years after Zenobia gives Rome a serious run for their money, we see another rebellious Arab queen. Mavia, or Mawia, leads a semi-nomadic Arab tribe against Rome in 378 CE. Her tribe are called the Tanukids, though we'll call them what many of the ancients do, the Saracens. They're based in southern Palestine and northern Sinai. Much like Teuta, we think she rises to power after her husband dies. Although she's often referred to as a queen, she's really the leader of a coalition of tribes, and holding onto her power might be a big part of why she takes up arms against Rome. So, what's up with Rome around now? Well, it's struggling. The current emperor, Valens, is having a devil of a time with the Goths. They first appeared in Roman territories in 238 CE and have been raiding ever since, causing some serious headaches. The Goth king Niva actually killed one of Rome's emperors, so they aren't an idle threat. Valens fights a Goth king named Athanaric between 367 and 69, then embraces his rival, Fritigern, when he comes to Rome for protection from the Huns. But provincial governors treat them badly, and these Goths revolt, kicking off the First Gothic War. Needing some extra soldiers for the effort, Valens asks leaders like Mavia to help him. But asking for auxiliary troops is a tricky diplomatic affair. Her husband once struck a deal with the Romans. They'd provide some warriors to fight in their army now and then, in exchange for Rome's support in other matters. But Mavia didn't sign on for that. No thank you. We don't know why she decides to turn on the Romans in this moment. Maybe, as a new queen, she expects the Romans to come and redraw the terms of their arrangement with her. Not just assume that, because she's a woman, she'll just blindly do whatever they say. Maybe, like Zenobia, she sees a weakness and goes for the jugular. Either way, the Romans are going to rue the day they didn't take her seriously. She's a well-organized and very capable commander, personally leading her armies. A 4th-century monk will write that, "Mavia, the queen of the Saracens, began to rock the towns and cities on the borders of Palestine and Arabia with fierce attacks." Another source tells us that, "All the regions of the east were at that time ravaged." They go into Phoenicia and Palestine, and even all the way down to Egypt. "Led by Mavia, a princess, who regarded not the sex which nature had given her and displayed the spirit and courage of a man." Okay. Our monk source also says that she "wore down the Roman army in frequent attacks, killed many, and put the rest to flight." It becomes pretty clear, pretty quickly, that the Romans can't beat Mavia. So they scramble to strike some kind of deal. Mavia is powerful enough to be able to dictate the terms of negotiations, and apparently she only really has one request. She wants Moses, a monk, to become bishop of her people. Some think this means her people are Christian, but the ancient sources disagree. It's just as likely that Mavia wants him for his other skills. For instance, he helps her negotiate new terms, because Mavia knows that making peace with the Romans does matter. It's said she sends some soldiers to help Valens in battle after that, and that she even gives her daughter in marriage to the Roman commander-in-chief, a guy named Victor. So imagine her surprise when, around 382 CE, Rome negotiates a peace with the Goths that's so favorable, Mavia's tribe revolts against them. We don't know if she's still ruling at this point. We don't really know anything about the rest of her life. But even if she isn't, I imagine she'd approve. I love to imagine it. Three women creating legends that even time couldn't quite erase. It kind of gives you warm and fuzzies, doesn't it? So raise your sword and let's toast to these epic queens. Thanks for listening. If you like The Explores, tell a friend about it. Leave a review wherever you listen, become a patron of the show, or just shoot me a message telling me what you love about it. Hearing from you always delights me. You can find show notes, including a transcript of this episode, at my website, theexplorespodcast.com. You can also find me on Instagram at theexplorespodcast.